From the Financial Times in London, I'm Andrew Jack, and this is FT News. A new exhibition at London's British Museum takes a historical look at migration. Telling the story of the Mediterranean island of Sicily, it shows how successive waves of conquest and settlement from Northern Europe, Africa, and the Middle East have shaped the island's history. In collaboration with the Financial Times, the museum invited Tom Holland, historian, Ian Goldin, economist, the FT's Rula Halaf, and Daniel Trilling, journalist and author, to discuss the exhibition and how migration is continuing to shape our modern-day societies. We've put together some excerpts from the discussion, which is chaired by the broadcaster Zainab Badawi. She began by asking historian Tom Holland about the origins of migration.
I think that migration has been part of the fabric of European history for thousands, indeed tens of thousands of years. We are ultimately all from Africa. The fact that we, as Homo sapiens, are in Europe is due to the migration of Cro-Magnons and the suppression of Neanderthals, however that happened. The fact that most of us in Europe speak the languages that we do reflects another wave of inward immigration, the Indo-Europeans. If we look at the Sicily exhibition, absolutely, it bears witness, you know, it is the crossroads of the Mediterranean, but it bears witness to the desire of the Greeks, of the Phoenicians, of the Carthaginians to better themselves, to conquer, to settle. If we then look at some of the other exhibitions that we've had in the British Museum, wonderful exhibition about the Celts. The Celts were well aware of the wealth that the Mediterranean had to offer. Notoriously, in 390 BC, they descended southwards and captured Rome. In 279, they sacked Delphi. They ended up settling in Galatia, where one day they would get a letter from St. Paul. It was a migration crisis that gave Julius Caesar his justification in launching the pacification of Gaul. And in fact, such was the nightmarish quality of the Gaul, the figure of the immigrant possessed of spiky punk-style hair and long swords, that I think you could make a case for the fact that the whole Roman Empire really was an extended and very violent exercise in immigration control. And of course, that immigration control lasted very effectively for several centuries until it collapsed under the strain of further waves of migration, which were refugees, because many of the people who crashed across the borders of the Roman frontier in the 5th century AD were escaping people behind them, ultimately, of course, the Huns, the most terrifying of the lot. But it would be ridiculous to deny that they were after loot as well. They wanted the riches that the Roman world had to offer.
Ian, so I think you've got a slightly more sort of current perspective on this, but does that resonate with your studies? Because you've just written a book, The Age of Discovery, and you've written a book on migration.
I have a very different sense of historical migration, of not necessarily being warfare and conquest, but actually being a most extraordinary story of exceptional people integrating in societies around the world and creating leaps forward of civilization. So what I took away from the Sicily exhibition was something else, of this Norman ruler who was integrating with Arabic craftsmen, embracing them.
That's Roger II, isn't it?
Yeah, not only to rule, but to actually create something which was very different to either society having before. And that, to me, is the story of migration. It leads to these massive leaps forward. And, of course, the Romans had slaves, and they had many, many, many migrants of different dimensions. I think that's one of the reasons they were so effective, is because they were able to get people from around the world to work for them and to come and advise them and to give them skills and knowledge. And the story of Britain today, of course, is a story of migration over the last 1,000 years. Anyone that really wants to see the funny side of this should read Bloody Foreigners, the brilliant book by Robert Winder, who tells about the successive waves and each one despising the next. But it's a very, very old story. And it makes us Britain as great as it is today. It's unimaginable to think of any of the achievements of Britain without these successive waves at every turn, every 20 or 30 years, new people coming. Now, if you look around the world and look at exceptional achievements, why some places are great and why some places are not, I would attribute a lot of the dynamism in societies and a lot of the great leaps forward in civilizations to migration, because migrants are exceptional people.
Okay. Rula, give us from your perspective this distinction between migrants and refugees and whether it is a distinction worth making and the kind of impact that it's had on the region you're interested in.
I have been looking, covering the story of migration for several years, mainly looking at the Syrian refugees, and they are to be described in most cases as refugees because they are escaping civil war. And there are, of course, rules that govern the treatment of refugees, UN rules that govern the treatment of refugees, whereas for migrants, if you want to settle in a country, then it is the national government that decides on the criteria. I'd like to put migration in perspective today. I'd like to give you just some figures. In Lebanon today, there are 1.5 million Syrian refugees for a population of 4 million people. The migrant crisis is 1 million Syrian refugees for a European population of 500 million. Let me take you to the UK. What are we, 63 million, 64 million? 5,000 Syrian refugees have reached the UK since 2011, 5,000. I mention these numbers because migration is actually a manageable issue. Yes, it is emotional. It does create problems for certain communities, for certain societies, but it is manageable. And I think one just needs to look back at Lebanon or even Jordan today, where there are about 2 million Syrian refugees, to understand that this is an issue that can be managed, particularly when we are talking about people who need it so badly. For every refugee that we argue about, this is one refugee who is not able to leave Syria, who is actually forced to live under barrel bombs, in some areas under a policy of starvation. And I think that what has been lost in the debate in Europe and indeed in the UK is the people themselves.
Thank you very much indeed, Rula. I'm sure we'll come back to some of those things that you've said presently. But let's introduce Daniel Trilling. You are editor of New Humanist.
That's right.
And you've talked a great deal, haven't you, with a lot of these migrants, refugees, whatever you want to call them, and are writing their true stories. You like to look at the human story of these people.
Yes, that's right. So my research has been on what's come to be called the refugee crisis in Europe, and I've spent the last 2 or 3 years travelling around to different border areas of the European Union and interviewing people and then following their progress as they move through Europe. And the way that I've come to think of it, I think as Rula very clearly pointed out, the scale of displacement globally shows that most refugees are moving and being hosted in countries outside of Europe. So I think something like 80% of the world's refugees at the moment are hosted in developing nations. But the crisis and the story that's got the most attention is what's been happening on the borders of Europe. And I think this is because what's happening is that a refugee crisis is coming into contact with a European border crisis. It's happening because of the way that the EU is structured. So in order to preserve that internal zone of free movement where EU citizens have the right to travel around and live and work in other EU countries, there's been this increasingly militarized border system constructed on the edges of the European Union to keep out unwanted outsiders. And what's happened is that when increased numbers of refugees have come towards Europe, they've come into contact with this very harsh and very chaotic border system. And Sicily is one of the front lines of that crisis. The EU border policies are using countries like Italy and Greece as buffer zones to try and keep as many of these migrants from travelling onwards. So this is actually, you know, this is the responsibility of all of the EU, but Italy is being left largely to accommodate these people by themselves. And what's happened, these people that I've met there and interviewed, you will find that, unlike in other parts of Europe where people have been able to move around, many of the migrants that I met in Sicily have been housed in inadequate accommodation on the edges of towns where they're left on very low subsistence payments and are reduced to begging or working for poverty wages on local farms or in restaurants or in other bits of service industries. I think most people here would probably agree that, you know, there's a moral case for accommodating and protecting refugees, but we perhaps need to treat people who are coming for economic reasons differently. And what I would say that Europe's crisis at the moment is in the process of sifting what it considers genuine refugees out from among what it considers the economic migrants. And I think what people don't realise in general is just how violent and debilitating that process of sifting out these people is, and the really damaging effects it's having on these quite vulnerable people who are arriving on the shores of Europe and on Sicily today.
What would you say, Ian, because this is really your area, globalisation, what animates the difficulties for migrants? Is it the economics, you know, the taking our jobs and so on, or is it that hostile, different,
it's,
other?
It's not economics. You know, all the studies, and I've looked at them for the US, for Europe, for the UK, demonstrate that migrants create jobs. They don't actually reduce wages. They don't increase unemployment. They put more into taxes than they take out in benefits. And they must probably account for at least 0.5% higher growth rates in the UK than would be the case at lower levels of migration. They also would create much higher levels of debt in the UK if they were to be reduced in numbers. And that's not including the students, which is a whole other dimension, and whether the students can stay in the dynamism they add. In the US, it's thought that over 60% of invention in the US comes from migration, and all the iconic firms you can think of in Silicon Valley are migrant-founded, and most of the Academy Award winners and Nobel Prize winners are, and it's no accident. So it's not an economic argument at all. And I would challenge anyone to give me evidence that migrants are bad economically for any country. And indeed, what's really surprising about the EU, when you have 60% unemployment of youth in the south of Spain or in Greece, is how few migrants migrate unless they can get a job. And it's very different to the refugee situation, which I believe is totally an ethical and moral question. You can make an enormous difference through your economic policies, like, do you allow them to work? Do you give them language training? Do you facilitate them going home? All of those things really do matter. And how do you distribute them around the country? And there are many, many important questions. But the decision of how many refugees we take is different to the decision of how many economic migrants. Economic migrants should be what's good for the economy. Refugees is, do we want to let people die?
I must come to Rula then here, because you raised the issue of refugees, and you reminded everybody that the vast number of Syrian refugees are actually accommodated in countries in the region.
What would have prevented, I think, the European refugee crisis is if enough funds had been invested in the border
in
areas.
The region.
And I think that people just did not realize. But what we also forget, why did people decide to move? You're a refugee, you're displaced. You and the first place you go is right across the border. After a few years, you realize, one, my kids aren't going to be educated. I can't get a job. There isn't going to be peace in Syria, and therefore, this is the second wave of migration that you saw. This was the result of people realizing that they won't be going home.
So they
might as well look for a better life.
I think that hanging over this whole debate really has been the question of, why should we care? Why should we give a toss about people who are not like us? And I think that the reason for that is probably a kind of subliminal buried memory of the parable of the Good Samaritan. It's very telling, I think, that Angela Merkel is the daughter of a pastor who grew up absolutely familiar with the Beatitudes. And I think that that sense of Christian responsibility to the weak and the poor and the oppressed has obviously been focused further by guilt at what happened, both with imperialism and specifically in the case of Germany with Nazism. But it's important to recognise as well that that Christian heritage works against welcoming refugees. It's telling that the Prime Minister of Hungary,
Orbán,
despite being an atheist, has suddenly announced that he is the defender of Christendom, and the sense of, you know, the need to defend the frontiers of Christendom against an onslaught of sort of Ottoman types is very strong. So I think that essentially, as Europeans, we face a crisis because the way that we have redeemed ourselves from the guilt of imperialism and of fascism is to say that our values are universal, are global, that we are one with all the peoples of the world. And now the peoples of the world are turning up on our doorstep, and we're being required to put our money where our mouth is. And the question is, really, those of you who've seen The Hunger Games, you know, are we Parnem or are we not?
Thanks for listening. You heard the voices of Zainab Badawi, the broadcaster, Tom Holland, author and historian, Ian Golden, Professor of Globalization and Development at Oxford University, Rula Halaf, Deputy Editor of the Financial Times, and Daniel Trilling, Editor of New Humanist magazine.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.